Listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM.
Wednesday, February 16th, WGXC has so many local creative community voices live on the radio at 90.7 FM, including at 11 a.m. It's time for Mayuka Fojina's show, Mirage Station. She's from Saugerties but is live in Acra at the WGXC Wave Farm, broadcasting until noon when we go to Main Street in Catskill, where Spike Priggen hosts the Bedazzled Radio Hour until 2 p.m., live from his Spike's Record Rack store there. Then, later in the day at 4 p.m., the WGXC Afternoon Show is live in Hudson from the WGXC studio in the First Presbyterian Church basement on Warren Street. And there's a talk of the Super Bowl halftime show today among host Vern Cross, Kamal Johnson, Ed Mack, and others. Then at 7 p.m., we're live from New York City with a simulcast of the Off the Hook show from WBAI in New York. That's the show from the hackers at the 2600 Collective. They're on until 8 p.m. when we're live from Hudson with Rock and Roll High School from Peter McPartland and Anya Kanovskaya. Then at 10 p.m., we're live from Ulster County with Jeff Economy and his Snack Point Charlie show. And then after the news at midnight, we stay live in Ulster County until 2 a.m. with Peter Aaron's Go Go Kitty show, simulcast from Radio Kingston and on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Delmar Wellness Center of Alachua, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Good morning. This is Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin Maiman, joining you live from WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM. Today, a local Columbia County author, writer named Peter Matheson Wheelwright. Peter is going to tell us a story about his new novel, which has to do with all sorts of Catskills and Hudson Valley related things, including the flooding of Gilboa about 100 years ago now to make way for the reservoirs, a pioneering local female scientist named Winifred, wonderful name. We'll hear more about her in a bit. And also, of course, Peter's going to tell us the story about how this book came together, the research. It's a historical novel, but there's fact, there's fiction, and it's quite wonderful. First, though, let's listen to some music.
Quietly open my eyes, but I never see. Sean. There's no such thing. There's no such thing. There's no such thing. There's no such thing. Let me tell you a true story.
Thank you.
This is Ginger Radio Hour. Let's get you caught up on all the tracks in reverse order. That just there was Till I Get There by Leo Nocentelli. Before that, we heard from Marcia Griffiths' wonderful song, Here I Am, cover of course, Come and Take Me. Three Teens Kill Four with Circumscript, was from a vinyl copy I have, and we open the show with The Cure, Pictures of You. So let's get to this wonderful novel, The Doorman. I'd like to describe the novel properly here. I have a lot of thoughts about it, but I think the book cover does a really nice job. So here we go. Let me give you the background on this novel by Peter Matheson Wheelwright. A mix of historical fact and fiction, The Doorman is based on actual events that took place at the town of Gilboa, New York, during the construction of the Schoharie Reservoir in 1917. That year, as work began on the dam, there was a discovery of fossils in the sandstone quarries. A young paleontologist named Winifred Goldring, I told you we'd talk about Winifred, made the identification of an ancient forest flooded during the Devonian period, approximately 350 million years ago, when the Earth's botanical explosion of oxygen opened the evolutionary path for humankind. However, the reservoir water was needed by New York City, and the fossils were soon lost again in the flooding of the doomed town of Gilboa. The novel is a fictionalized account of the fossil discovery and its aftermath, narrated by a disaffected NYC doorman during the decommissioning of the Central Park Reservoir in 1993. The doorman traces the consequences across three generations of the flooded town, the patronized woman who made the fossil identification, and the violence that occurred in the clash of nature and the city. Capital N, nature. So this novel came at a really interesting moment for me. Today in this ACRA studio, we're just a couple miles from the Karo fossil forest discovery from 2019. That forest is 385 million years old, right here in Karo. That has now eclipsed the Gilboa fossil discovery of 150 years ago. Just by a couple million years, but it matters. Please excuse the banging. There's some construction here. So I'd like to open all of this up because I've been thinking so much about ancient tree forests and fossils. That's really at the core of this book. Peter was gracious enough to talk to me last week. We had a wonderful conversation. He also did a reading, which I'd like to open with here, which is Winifred. It's a good description and the introduction of Winifred. Here we go.
So this is early in the book when we're meeting Winifred Goldring kind of for the first time. Winifred Goldring had been at the museum for 6 years, attached to what some of her colleagues referred to as, quote, the Garden Club, unquote. The director of the State Museum was a friend of her father's and had reluctantly taken her on to fill an empty niche in the paleontology department, botany, flowers and plants, the ancient ones. She was the first woman on the scientific staff and a gamble. Fred, as she was called behind her back, was considered to have a man's turn of mind. This had originally been meant as a compliment during her schooling in paleontology, but it had taken a sarcastic turn when she took her schooling into the profession. Mastering the physical universe was just that, the work of masters, not mistresses. She had heard it all her young life in school and elsewhere. The predictive sciences, physics and chemistry, where mankind's future was being determined, were not for women. Womankind had no aptitude for the required mathematics and logical inference. Cool precision, not easily heated passion, was necessary in the laboratory. Rolled up sleeves, not long skirts and dewy emotions. Even in biological and anatomical research, putrescent organs were unseemly in delicate hands meant for holding children. But it was worse in Winifred's chosen field of science, the science that looks backwards in time to understand the present. Hunting for the origins of life meant rough travel around the Earth's lithic sphere in search of rough rock faces and the minute markings of fossils embedded in titanic folds. Far beyond civilization, far beyond a woman's safety. But Winifred Goldring had always had a formidable and fearless mind, and she was insistent when it came to the Gilboa fossils. She'd heard that Gilboa was a particularly disorderly civilization with its roughneck clash of nations, dispirited and dark-minded locals, and the relentless mayhem of machines ripping apart the ground beneath them all. Still, she could take care of herself as she had always done. When Winifred came to work and displayed her father's black powder-framed Colt 45 to the director as a means of reassuring him, he felt only embarrassment for her and tried to put her off. Fieldwork is dangerous, especially for girls in knickers, he said. It's all right for a man to make the trip, but a girl, even armed with a revolver, never. The director had intended his remark kindly, but he was serious. The men, when they could be spared, would be sent to Gilboa instead. She held her ground, standing over him with folded arms as he sat at his desk. Perhaps it was the way she held the gun, confident and relaxed in one hand, nestled into the crook of her elbow. or just that he couldn't bear to stare down the steel in her eyes. He finally gave in. It would be unpaid leave. She'd have to make her own way and find her own lodging. That was fine with her. She had a sister in Gilboa, and she felt it was payment enough to get there ahead of the men, which she did.
That's Peter Matheson Wheelwright, the dulcet tones of Peter, reading from The Doorman, his new novel. And one of the characters in that novel, which is based on a historical figure, Winifred, is really an incredible figure in and around Albany and Gilboa, and he's going to talk a little bit more about her in part of our conversation here in a bit. We had a long conversation. I have an excerpt from it here. I asked him to talk a little bit about his background, how he came to the area, and how he thinks about the role of a naturalist, both in his own work, but also in a work of fiction. Here's more from that.
It's funny. I actually, as I said, I grew up in the Berkshires my father was a physician, but we had a, I guess what you would call a gentleman's farm. And, we were a rowdy band of five boys and a dear youngest sister. And we were very involved with the outdoor world on our place. We had to work it. It was part of our thing. My father was a strict disciplinarian and put us to work. And, but interestingly enough, and he was very involved he was a birder. He was a hunter. He was a real outdoorsy guy. And when I decided I wanted to go to architecture school, in a way that was viewed as treachery among the naturalists, because, there's no profession more violent than architecture to the natural world. We're digging up everything to put up our buildings and so on. But I was given a little bit of grace because my grandfather had also been an architect, even though, and this is the same grandfather who went on to become a trustee of the Museum of Natural History and vice president of the Audubon Society. So I had a little bit of fallback room there, but I think I always viewed myself, even as I practice architecture as I wouldn't call myself a naturalist, but I would say I was extremely thoughtful and sensitive to the natural world. And my teaching in architecture, and I taught at Parsons School of Design for 35 years, I taught environmental philosophy, environmental design, and was, when I was ahead of the school for 10 years, my main focus was bringing in ideas about sustainability and what they call resilience nowadays into the curriculum. And I was quite successful at it. And it's one of the hallmarks, frankly, of that architecture program at the New School. So I wasn't a naturalist by discipline, but I was by sentiment, I guess.
I think that's fair, and I think that counts.
Yeah.
can you tell us more about the writer's room or building or studio that you built during the pandemic?
We got this little house back in the 80s, mid 80s, that had no plumbing or heating. A big family had lived there with an outhouse and a well, and they had, the last of them had died, and it was bought by a woman who I love telling this story, so I'm going to tell it anyway. proceeded to grow acres and acres of marijuana on the land. And it was, and she got busted. It was the biggest drug bust in Columbia County history. They came in on helicopters and swept her away, and she went off to prison. And we got the place in a drug sale. And the house is a teeny little house. It's about, I guess, maybe 1,600 square feet on an old dry set stone foundation that was part of the original house. And it's so teeny, and our family was getting so big, and I couldn't write up there any longer. So I, you know, every architect wants to have the opportunity to build themselves something before they lay down their weary bones. And that's, so I designed this cute little studio that is completely off the grid. I mean, well, it's on the grid, but it's got solar panels. It's got a composting toilet. The water comes from an office cooler, which I've got bolted to a sink, which drains into the downspout of my roof drain. So and it's heated by a wood burning stove. So it's a kind of, you know, quirky little place that's about 300 yards from the house. And I sit there and got a little loft. It's a sort of split. It's got a upper level loft where my wife and I actually go and sleep when our house gets full of kids and grandkids. So it's really great. Now I've got fabulous views from there. And yeah, my uncle Peter Matheson had a little writing studio, and this was sort of modeled on that. And he always said that the most important thing is what you see out your window, because it's got to be good, but not too good, or you won't be able to write.
That's great advice. I've heard that a lot from various, I think maybe Joyce Carol Oates or somebody I read recently was talking specifically about her writing room and the importance of that window, because she values so much time staring. You know, the work of a writer is not just writing, but staring at something as they think.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I joked about it. I could never understand why Peter Matheson, when I would visit him in the studio, his window looked right onto a set of about three bushes that were very close to the window. And so he was able to sort of see the detail of the flowers on one bush versus the flowers on the other. And then there was a little opening in it where he had long, deep space view down towards the ocean. And mine is sort of just the opposite. I have this sort of great, vast view out there to the land, and a little thing hangs off the roof, little piece where I can have a little sort of bud boss.
So you can have both the minuscule and the maximum.
There you go.
Yeah. That's tremendous. So that's where this book was came out of. That was how this book was finished.
Yeah. I don't know if I would have been able to finish it had it not been for that studio. I mean, I probably would have, but I was really struggling with this thing. I just wasn't, you know, the way I write, and I don't, you know, every writer I think has their tactic, but many, many years ago, I heard John Irving make this comment about how he writes, and it was like, boom, it was a real meatball for me. He said, I know what the last line of the book is, and then I write toward it. And that's what it's like, you know. It's, I often think, well, when you're writing, it's as if you're out in the national forest in Montana, and you've got about, you know, 500 head of cattle in the national forest that you have to round up and get through an 8-foot wide gate. That's what it's like. You know, you've written all this stuff and it's spread all over the place, and you got to figure out how it all connects, how it all hooks up in the end. And that's your last line. It's got to get, that's where that gate is. It's to that last line. So I knew how this book was going to end. I just didn't know how I was going to get there until I did. And, you know, that's the way it goes, I guess.
It's, again, it's a tremendous book because of the way that it, I think you write very well about place. Now, maybe that's because I know the places you're writing about, but either way, well, maybe then that's even more of a compliment, because I think it's very, the places, you get the places really right. I think you get the Catskills right. I think you get the city right. And I think that's a really wonderful skill when you're trying to also bring all of these characters in and out of these specific settings, which the characters are very important, but in some ways the places are the most important thing in your book.
Well, they're characters too. That's sort of the way I think about it, you know, that the places are really important characters. You know, they have their own way of being, and they respond to events, you know, they produce events, you know, they're active, they're agents in any kind of a story, I think. So you gotta be, you can't be inattentive, you know, to place. It's really important.
Well, it's really wonderful to see the Catskills starring in your novel as a character.
Yeah. Well, I love driving around and, you know, just sort of absorbing it. You know, that was my research on the Catskills, was just driving around and looking and smelling and, you know, feeling the space of it. You know, and the sort of sadness in a funny way of driving around the Schoharie, you know, and that reservoir. And I went, you know, Winifred, I don't know if you've seen, you know, there is a little display of the Gilboa fossils alongside the road at the Schoharie Reservoir with pictures of Winifred on a big billboard. It's kind of funky and run down, but there is the Gilboa Historical Society. They're in a little building there about a mile from the reservoir and trying to keep alive the story of the original town.
Peter Matheson Wheelwright. His new book is called The Doorman. As you heard him say there, it's all about fossil towns, fossil trees, and families. Check it out. I really enjoyed it. It is, of course, available wherever you get books, but I know for sure it's also available at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck. I want to thank Peter again for taking the time to chat, and I want to encourage everybody to think hard about fossil forests and what we do with them, because here in Cairo, that's something we're going to have to figure out soon. We have a real treasure just miles from here that's 385 million years old, oldest fossil forest in the world. Okay, I've said my piece. Let's listen to some music.
Seen your dreams. of your mouth now that you have the facts on your side. Take a moment to reflect where you're from. Let reason guide you. See all tracks lead you out from the dark. See all tracks lead you out to the stars. Thank you.
back in reverse order. Here's what you heard. That was Mellow from Florist. Before that, the wonderful Jose Gonzalez with Leaf Off the Cave. And before that, the cover of Yoko Ono's Who Has Seen the Wind by David Byrne and Yola Tango. Before it gets too noisy here, I'm going to take us to the end with some Keith Jarrett, who's going to help us think hard about ancient forests. Have a wonderful week.